rebounding slightly today. So 2 days of slight gains, not super convincing that we found a bottom in this trade.
The more concern about tomorrow morning on the opening, does this accelerate when everyone's really involved and the bond market gets involved? Do these losses really extend? So, it really turned hard this afternoon when oil turned, and that's the impetus for the sell-off.
We do agree that we're in late cycle, but bear markets are pretty rare, and they happen for very defined reasons. They happen if commodities spike, they happen if the Fed is way too aggressive, they happen if valuations are at extremes, like the dot-com bubble, and then they happen because of recession.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Signs of a possible economic slowdown, trouble emerging in the corporate debt markets this week, think GE. Oil inventories continue to build, and we're asking, have we found a bottom yet? But as many on Wall Street are saying, hey, we're not panicking yet. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me from Vermilion Research in Hour 1 will be Dave Nikoski. Key theme coming from Dave is something is amiss here. Not quite sure. You got breaking significant trend lines. I don't care whatever index you're looking at, whether you're looking at the Dow, the S&P, the Russell, or even some of the overseas markets. He goes, markets could retest lows, and he's worried about the extremes and passive index investing and what that might portend if we get a bigger sell-off. And he's overweight only three sectors right now, and you're going to want to hear which ones. Also coming up, Ryan Sweet will be joining us from Moody Analytics. He says GDP momentum should continue growth into the next year, but definitely that growth is going to be slowing. He sees the Fed raising interest rates at 3.5%, overshooting. And when it comes to next year, 2019 is going to be a tale of two halves. And you're going to want to hear what he has to say about that with a recession in 2020. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And coming up in Hour 2, after the volatility with this week's oil prices, you might be thinking, what the hell just happened? How can we go from record prices for the year and calls for $100 oil by year end to a bear market in oil with prices near $50 in just 1 month? What changed? Is this the sign of an approaching recession? A new glut in oil? What's going on? Well, Jim Poplava and I, we unpack all these questions and provide some much-needed insight into the fluctuating oil market. Also, in the second hour, Jim and I will answer the question having to do with record economic growth this year and high corporate profits. And really, all of us are wondering, can the economy keep up the pace? Is this as good as it gets? All of that's coming up in hour two. Well, turning to the wrap-up report, this week the S&P 500 closed down 1.6%, the NASDAQ closed virtually flat, down 0.15%, and the Dow Industrials closed up 0.5%. The two hardest hit sectors this week were the S&P 500 consumer discretionary sector, down 3.3%, on the back of disappointing retail earnings announcements, as well as the S&P 500 technology sector, which was down 2.3%. As a result of warnings from Apple's suppliers, Skyworks Solutions, Lumentum, and Qorvo. And it seems we should probably talk more about oil, which had fallen 12 consecutive trading days until things turned around on Wednesday. That fall was a record since going back to 1983. And according to Deutsche Bank, the 7% decline on Tuesday puts that day in the 99.4 percentile of worst day moves going back 35 years. So, Ryan, what can you tell us about the markets this week?
Well, Chris, you pretty much summed it up already. I think that's a wrap. Seriously, though, those were some of the key details this week with Apple suppliers stoking kind of growth concerns over the demand for Apple products. And each time the suppliers warned or were downgraded in the following days this week, it affected the whole group. So when Lumentum warned, Qorvo was down 6%, Skyworks was down 4%, Cirrus Logic was down 10%. You know, this was just across the spectrum. And a lot of these are semiconductors, which really hurt that industry group. and that industry group has done so well for the past 2 years, and the weakness we've seen since the second half has really been disturbing and has kind of led to a lot of these growth concerns. So speaking of semiconductors, NVIDIA and Applied Materials reported this week very disappointing news and kind of a cautious outlook for the next quarter. And, you know, Applied Materials is specifically the company that provides all of the fabrication equipment, chips, and integrated circuits needed to produce those semiconductors. So they're well ahead of that whole cycle. So hearing the negative results, that just really hurt on top of all the news from Apple's suppliers. You know, it just wasn't great for technology this week at all. The biggest retail season of the year is right around the corner, Chris, with Black Friday a week from now. And if you recall from last year, listening to the show, that's when I went almost gaga over the retail sector due to the season's just phenomenal results last year, right after the holiday November sales. Now, speaking of retail, many retails reported on earnings this week, including Nordstrom's, Walmart, Williams-Sonoma, Dillard's, and JCPenney, off the top of my head. And the retail industry group was down this week on an overall disappointing showing from these companies, overshadowing the report on at the same time what we saw with the October retail sales, which were actually really great in September. Of course, September's now way back in the rearview mirror. Actually, they were up 0.8% following a revised decline of 0.1% in September. So a great showing in retail sales for October. But again, like I said, that's kind of in the rear view right now. All the comments we're hearing from these retail companies, that's forward looking. But just ahead, I was reading on a report on Friday from the National Retail Federation's 2018 holiday sales forecast, and they're calling for year-over-year growth between 4.3% and 4.5% for this holiday season. And that's above the five-year average that we've seen of 3.9%. So still projecting great growth ahead, but not quite the 5.3% growth level we saw in 2017 that really kicked off that nice performance in industry group at the end of last year. With all of the growth concerns this earnings season, it will be very important to watch how the holiday season kicks off. CNBC, Bloomberg, everybody's going to be talking about it. We'll be talking about it, and we'll be looking at the results just to give investors that feeling and coming away with what do the growth concerns actually look like. Because, you know, beyond all of the earnings season and where things have gone, there's many other indicators right now that are pointing towards robust growth, with average hourly earnings higher this year than they were a year ago, unemployment at decade lows, and then, of course, consumer confidence, which is up near an 18-year high, Chris.
And Amazon is as big as they get in the online retail group. We know they've given disappointing guidance that looks to be only a 15% increase over last year, while last year's growth was 36% last year over 2016. They recently announced free shipping and no minimum purchase as a way to, probably as a way to continue their lead, which comes off the heels of Target offering free 2-day shipping, which is only for the holiday season ending December 22nd. But Ryan, Jim Poplav and I are going to be speaking about oil, doing a segment in the next hour, which oil has obviously suffered quite the correction here. It wasn't that long ago that it was one of the best performing assets in 2018. It's now down 2.5% year to date. But can you give us just a market wrap encapsulated version of what's going on with oil?
Yeah, Chris, it was a major story last week when Trump gave those 8 country waivers. It's, you know, I kind of like to think of it right now as what Ray Dalio mentioned many years ago in 2012, calling the deleveraging process in the U.S. a beautiful deleveraging process, which was a certain amount of austerity, certain amount of debt restructuring, and of course, that certain amount of money printing we got from the Fed. Now, I would call this, what we've seen in energy, a beautiful political maneuvering by President Trump. I haven't given a whole lot of accolades. This is definitely one of them. And what he's been able to do with OPEC by telling them prices were too high and then declaring renewed sanctions on Iran. Of course, what would happen? Their global supply would go down with all those new sanctions. So he was forcing those sanctions and supplies to drop. OPEC, of course, to counterbalance that, raised production. And then what did we see last week? Those countries were granted waivers. And so that global supply that was going to be pulled out of the market came right back. So OPEC has been caught holding the barrel as you will, in this case, and is scrambling to reverse their missteps over production. And early in the week, Saudi Arabia said it would reduce oil exports by 500,000 barrels per day in December, with a story by Bloomberg suggesting that a cut of 1 million or more might be needed. There were numbers later on in the week talking about 1.4 million. OPEC provided a report also this week forecasting that non-OPEC supply will be up 120,000 barrels per day and demand would be down 70,000 barrels per day in 2019. So that was not a bullish outlook, just the opposite, very bearish. Looks like OPEC will be meeting probably in the next month or so in December, right before year-end, to really announce major policy shifts, likely a cut. You know, we're getting these trial balloon little articles now that that's what they want to do. Let's see what happens. That's the next catalyst for oil.
Well, we'll continue to look for that. The drop since October 3rd, it's really been a doozy. It's down more than, I think, a little more than 25%. Also, a couple of the headlines that we've been talking about in the past, we've heard about Italy in the past. Of course, the tariff situation just kind of seems to really constantly crop up in the news. Any additional information about those topics, Ryan?
Yeah, of course, we're going to continue to get trade talk, news headlines on almost a daily basis as the G20 is right around the corner at the end of this month. And we did get some more talk this week. The Trump administration helped prop markets a few times. Larry Kudlow specifically talking about healthy economy. Would like to do energy infrastructure bill. And then he believes the talks are very positive. He also said later on the week that they're happening at all levels of government, the administration. So Trump towards the end of the week said the U.S. may not need to impose additional tariffs, and all around it appears there has been what seems to be a ceasefire between both sides on rhetoric right before, obviously, major trade talks at the end of this month at the G20. Again, this is all rumors that we're seeing coming across the market tape with very little substance, but it just shows you how anticipatory investors are of a reaction and of a trade deal, any kind of news that could alleviate this uncertainty over the market. And I guess, you know, that also goes for obviously the machine learning algos as well. Besides that, you know, there was some more political back and forth between Italy and Europe. Of course, Italy now had to respond to Europe's official letter, and they did. Italy revised the budget projections, which were left the same as a deficit of 2.4%. budget deficit, and a growth projection still at 1.5% for 2019. Obviously, many, the IMF and others, have some real serious doubts around that number. And since there really hasn't been any contagion as a result of Italy in other debt markets, it appears that the European Commission will probably institute the excessive deficit procedure. And so we'll be waiting to hear more probably in December. And on to Brexit, I haven't talked a whole lot about it because it's just been a lot of noise going back and forth. And I didn't want to bug our listeners with some of the news on that. But there was an agreement this week. Theresa May put something forward with her cabinet and they came to a collective agreement. And that suggests maybe it wasn't unanimous. Obviously, we've seen some objections in her cabinet to a lot of the moves recently. But it now seems that it's time now for Parliament to begin the discussion about it and eventually put it to vote, probably in the first half of December. So December, again, policy front is likely to be a big month for both EU politics and what that means for currencies, equities, and the credit markets of those areas. They're likely going to respond accordingly, like we saw this week when Theresa May said we've come to that collective agreement. Markets rallied strongly from that news. So December will be another major policy catalyst month to be watching.
Well, Ray Dalio may have coined the term beautiful deleveraging in describing the debt cycle. But Ryan, that was a beautiful report on the week. And next up, we'll hear from Rob Bernard, wealth advisor at Financial Sense Wealth Management, with a special credit market report.
Hello, everybody. Rob Bernard here from Financial Sense with a quick update on U.S. Treasury market and on money market rates. U.S. Treasuries rallied up in price, down in yield to close this week at a 307 from a yield of 323 on November 8th. Also, the 30-year Treasury rallied as well as from a 345 to a 332. Interesting. Money market rates have really rallied in the yield category to a 2.17. So all you people out there that are getting less than 2.17, give us a call. 888-486-3939. Ask for Rob Bernard.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
You know, there's this notion that, that participants in the market have that the economy, the global economy, is sort of a zero-sum game. You know, the pie is 12 inches in diameter, and if I have more of that pie to myself, then I eat more. And that's not the case. So basically, the history of trade in the world is that increasing global trade increases as the size of the pie. It goes from, 12 inches to 14 inches to 16 inches to, 20 inches. So, you can see over time that when America and other trading partners have opened their borders and increased the amount of trade through, for example, NAFTA or the WTO, that the global economy has gotten bigger, and that's been better for America as well as for other countries. What the Fed data is showing, widely accepted among economists, is that you're actually decreasing the size of the global economy. So this is a bona fide, quantified threat to the expansion.
Well, after hitting records in the month of September, the stock market gave back all its gains in the following month. Then we had a big rally last week, but this week, that big rally is starting to fade. Joining us on the program is Dave Nikoski from Vermilion Research. Dave, I want to begin with a piece that you did, which is called All Is Not What It Seems. And the gist of it is something seems amiss with the market. Let's talk about that.
You know, we're breaking some pretty significant trend lines, especially with some of the leadership stocks, the FANG stocks, to be exact. Yeah. But, we've been taking kind of more of a defensive posture since the January-February sell-off. As the breath of the market, while it remained good, you started to see a lot of sectors fall by the wayside that certainly weren't indicating that the economy was, is not as strong as what GDP numbers were reflecting. And when I'm referring to that, I'm, referring to basic materials. Energy obviously stalled out here a little later in the cycle. Manufacturing began to break down. And I think as Hannibal Lecter once said it, you can only live off of relatives for so long. And since we're relative strength analysts, you started to have some breakdowns in relative strength within the financials. And I don't need the financials to lead. I just can't have them hitting 26 and 52 week lows. And they started giving up their relative strength performance, much earlier in the year than we would be looking for.
Dave, something that you noted, which we've been following as well, we've seen some great GDP numbers, but the Fed continues to raise interest rates, and it looks like another one's coming next month, possibly. But take a look at the sectors of the economy that would be susceptible to higher interest rates. You've seen it in auto manufacturers. You've seen it in home building with the real estate market peaking in early May. You're seeing it with manufacturing. So if interest rates continue to trend higher and the Fed continues to raise, how many other sectors do you see starting to break down?
Yeah, I think, if you couldn't sell houses earlier in the year, when rates were much lower in terms of the 10-year yield, you go from 2.8 to 3.2, 3.3, I don't think you're going to sell that many more houses, especially when, most of the home builders are on their back. And it was our indication back in January, February, that everything that was long-term financed was rolling over. Our suggestion at that time was to move into stocks where you can walk in and pay $100 to get a good meal or a pair of pants or a shirt. I think that's held up very well. But I'm starting to see some little cracks in the armor. And, with those long-term finance products, whether it's housing, whether it's automobiles, whether it's furniture, anything that goes into the housing industry, Winnebago, Harley-Davidson, recreational vehicles, the one area that held up the best, actually, in terms of long-term financing was your boat manufacturers, which is kind of unusual. Again, unless we can get some reprieve from the Fed to back off of in terms of tightening, less than what they had indicated, I think that would be helpful for the market. But, you know, you also got the turmoil in the emerging markets.
Yeah, because you have emerging markets breaking down. It was reported yesterday, Germany, which has been the stellar performing economy in Europe, they had negative GDP print. You have a negative GDP print in Japan. China's economy is slowing down. And I did notice, Dave, that Chairman Powell finally mentioned we're finally starting to watch what's going on overseas. So maybe he's coming to the conclusion, hey, what we're doing here is having an impact over there.
Yeah, I would hope that he's, you know, paying some attention to what's happening overseas. The strong dollar is obviously not helping us in terms of, you know, it's certainly keeping inflation down. And the question is do we want to see some inflation if the dollar certainly started a, you know, a descent from here? And I point back that, you know, the market is very similar in nature to what we saw in the late 2015, early 2016. And that was the emerging markets being plundered. You saw oil come down to $26 a barrel. Right now, you have a lot of tailwinds going with us for at least helping the emerging markets find a bottom. And that is that, you know, the largest incremental user of energy is the emerging markets. And with this decline in oil prices, I think that's kind of a tax cut for them. But again, I would like to see the dollar pull back from its safety trade. I'd like to see the emerging markets bottom. And from what my technical work is showing right now, we are showing some relative strength reversals in the foreign markets versus, you know, many of our major indices. And I think that's a positive sign. However, we're not breaking the absolute downtrend yet. But, you know, in my view as a technician, money chases performance. And, you know, you start to have these foreign markets start to move up. For instance, today is unusual because you actually have a strong dollar and the emerging markets are up. And so it seems like we're untying that tether that's prevented the foreign markets from going up. And that was the strong dollar. And that seems to be coming a little bit unhinged today. And not that one day makes a trend, but I like to see that type of tape action where you have value investors starting to, you know, look overseas. I'm seeing reversals. I run a number of screen on the emerging markets for the last 6 months. I come up with, you know, roughly 800 names on the 26-week price and relative strength highs versus the emerging market index. And yesterday I ran the screen, I came up with 1,100 names. And believe it or not, there's a lot of Shanghai and Shenzhen stocks, which, you know, most investors here won't touch, but I think it's incremental evidence that we're breaking a lot of downtrends in there with a lot of those stocks breaking above the 200-day, having positive inflections on price and relative strength. So I hope it's a underlying basis for, you know, us to start looking back at the emerging markets. You know, no one knows better what's going on in their country than the people that live there. And those are the stocks that the locals buy. So I'm sitting here on the sidelines, you know, waiting for the all clear signal in terms of breaking down trends. But I see some great, you know, individual action in individual stocks within China.
I want to talk about the major indexes. I don't care if you're looking at the S&P, you're looking at the Dow, you're looking at the NASDAQ, all broke below their 200-day moving averages. The Dow holding up the best. It's touching its 200-day. When you see major indexes break their 50, then they go through their 200-day, what is that telling you, number one? And number two, as bad as things may look right now on, let's say, daily charts, it's not looking any better when you start looking at weekly charts.
Yeah, and again, I think rather than jump the gun, and you know, it's certainly possible that, you know, the market is peaking out. We've seen peak earnings. I'm going to take kind of a more wait and see approach. And here's an example. If you look at the charts back in 2015, early 2016, you had the same type of damage that you have now. And what I want to see is I want to see the market get oversold. I want to see it come off the oversold levels. One of those indicators that we're using is, you know, the percentage of stocks above the 50-day and 200-day. Our indicator for the percentage of stocks above the 50-day, whether you look at the Russell 3000, 1000, or 2000, was that you hit extreme levels on the 50-day, which, you know, led to our great bounce. We've stayed on the sidelines. It's very rarely that you don't have a market that retests its lows, and you'd be reversals. You know, they're just extremely difficult to catch. I think that we're getting the retest now. I would like us to see what, you know, type of damage is done within each individual sector and see what may lead. My concern is on the FANG stocks, you're breaking some pretty significant uptrends. When you look at the growth to value ratio, we're hitting at least on a relative basis between those two particular indices, is you're back at the 2000 high. So, you know, the question becomes, you know, do we have a rotation into value? You know, what growth today may become value, you know, down the line. And I think that's something that we have to be cognizant of as technicians, to see that, you know, the market can certainly change.
Dave, you also have a checklist for signs that you're watching. I wonder if we can cover a few of those. You list a number of them: the dollar, defensive areas of the market emerging as leadership, the number of stocks below their 50-day and 200-day, the breadth of the market, large versus small cap. So there are a number of broader, bigger signs that you're looking at to give you a clue as to which direction this will head.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of a number of factors, and it's not like we can lay it onto one indicator in terms of finding a reversal. But bottoms take time, and they don't happen. You know, when you look at that 2015-16 correction, you were in that for, you know, roughly about 4 to 5 months, and that's what I would expect to see here. That, you know, we need a tug of war to establish, some form of lows back in 2015-16. You know, you did break to a new low in early 2016. It took out the 15 lows, and that was going back to the November time period. So, you know, again, it's going to take time, and time waits for no one, as we know. And so I think that as we move along here, you know, we're staying on the cautious side, but we're looking for screens in terms of percentage of stocks above the 50-day and 200-day, and I prefer the 200-day because that's longer-term oriented. But it doesn't mean that you aren't given opportunity while looking at the 50-day. And again, you can stay oversold for long periods of time. My other concern would be, Jim, that, you know, we have gotten into such extreme in passive investing that I think we need a shakeup with the average retail investor in the ETF structure. And you know, if you look at names like Apple, you know, in what funds held them, I mean, they're the top holdings in the top 10 value funds and top 10 growth funds. And, you know, everyone and their grandmother owns it. So that's my concern, is we get over-owned stocks, and then when they unwind very hard.
I want to move on to interest rates. Typically, Dave, if you go back to, for example, the periods you cited, 2015, 2016, if you were in stocks, okay, there was a major correction during that period of time. But if you were in bonds, they acted as a hedge. That hasn't worked out particularly well in the downturn in February and the downturn in October.
No, it hasn't. We've already got an indication from the Fed that they're going to stay on this gradual tightening. And I think that's what the concern is. You know, we have literally I hear a lot of people saying, well, rates are low from a historical standard going back 40, 50 years. And, you know, interest rates in the 70s were 16-18% on a house. I don't know that anyone in their grandmother is buying a house back in the 70s anymore. And we've seen rates double from the lows only 3 years ago. In terms of the 10-year yield. So in essence, what we're seeing is that the cost to buy a home has doubled. And I think if we look back in history and find other periods where interest rates doubled on a purchase of a home, you're going to have to lower the price of the home. So you have to bring the price or the sales price of a home, it has to come down, because it's all based on affordability. And if rates double, you have a lot less buying power.
And if I look at some of the things like you mentioned, autos have peaked, homeowners have peaked, manufacturers are in trouble. Even, for example, restaurants are showing signs of stumbling. You know, you mentioned a couple of years ago, rates have doubled. I mean, 2 years ago in 2016, you could have got a 30-year mortgage under 3.5. Today, it's close to 5%. So how much longer? I mean, let's say the Fed goes in December, they raise maybe one or two times next year. I just don't see, with the amount of debt and everything else, that we're going to get a Fed funds rate, as some project, up to 4%. I just don't see us getting that high.
Yeah, I think that we're going to see the Fed is more than likely going to go on hold if this, you know, volatility in the equity markets continues. If you continue to see home sales and automobiles flounder, I read one article, for instance, Ford's debt is trading virtually at junk level. I don't hear anyone talking about that, but that's pretty significant when you look at what's happening in the marketplace. And again, talking about relatives, it was my view that restaurants and retailers can't hold up the whole market. I know the consumer is 70% of the market, but if they're unwilling to commit to, financing something over 12 months back in January, I don't know what's going to force them to do it now with rates that much higher. So again, I think that we just have to go through a period of consolidation. It's going to be a tug of war. But again, I would believe that the market would do much better if we saw some money come into the value side of the market. It's underperformed dramatically. There's a lot of very inexpensive stocks out there, but they're not, fast growers. They're not fantastic names that everyone knows. But there's certainly, stocks trading at PEs of, below six. And it would seem that they're all going to go away from what I'm looking at on the charts.
Let's talk about something else. And you had this trifecta that was working against the market. You have a rising dollar, as we've seen recently. And until last month, you had rising oil prices. And then on top of that, you had corporate profits were at record levels. So you had the rising dollar and rising interest rates, and you also had rising oil prices. Now, at least oil prices pull back, so at least one aspect of the trifecta doesn't look as bad and maybe help.
Yeah, I think it's a tax cut for everyone. And what's interesting there is you have only just a few airlines that are near new highs. But a number of them have not responded to a drop of $21 in oil prices, which, is quite shocking to me. Why they're not getting a tailwind, per se. Excuse the pun, too.
So when you look at this market, given what we've had, you mentioned defensives are taking over in terms of leadership. You're seeing some encouraging signs in emerging markets. Let's talk about defensives, because in the month of October, if you looked at healthcare, if you looked at staples, if you looked at utilities, they held up well. What's your view of those three sectors now?
Well, we're overweight staples. We're market weight on utilities. We're overweight on healthcare. I still stand with that positioning because I don't think that I think that we can still get a good and just be going through a consolidation, much like 2015-16. Again, it's possible that we have a major top in the market. I'm going to stick with I think it's a more of a consolidation, and it's something just to make us all nervous at this juncture. But I think that you will see utilities peak out if the market makes a low. Again, I'm seeing some signs of the emerging markets start to outperform. I think that's as positive as we can be in terms of hoping for some type of reversal. Now, realize we put tariffs on many foreign goods that are imported in this country. But in a lot of those places, their currency has dropped to the same magnitude of what the tariffs are. So you almost cancel out the tariffs. And I guess to me, looking at it, I sit here and go, well, it's kind of a net neutral. And the question is, if the U.S. economy weakens much further, then I don't think the foreign markets will hold up at all, because we are the largest consumer and we have such significant trade deficits that we're the one thing that's probably propagating their market from falling that much further.
Final question. Taking a look at commodities, they have not done well. Oil was doing well. That was the leader this year. It has broken down, gotten into the 50s, which brings back that $40 to $60 ban in oil that existed for so long. About the only thing that's looking good right now is natural gas. Gold hasn't done well. Most commodities haven't. What's your take on them?
Well, everything in the commodity structure is showing that, there's a significant decline within consumption or demand within the commodity structure, whether it's the metals or, for that matter, even the soft grains. Energy seemed to kind of defy logic in terms of the dollar being strong and oil going up. And I think that's more of a combination of what Brent is doing, and it's tracking Brent. The U.S., for all practical purposes, we are finding enough oil and energy in our country to sustain at least what our consumption is. And I think that's the factor that why we have this disconnect between the U.S. dollar and crude oil. Natural gas had a huge spike, broke out to multi-year highs. It's coming back in today. But if you looked at the future curves, looking out to April of next year, you know, you're pricing, last time I checked, around $2.80 per million cubic feet. So the future curve was not suggesting that it's going to be a long-term problem. It's more of a short-term issue in terms of what we're seeing in terms of reserves of natural gas, because we are at that five-year low, well below the five-year low in terms of what our reserves are for natural gas. So, you know, I think that's what brought up the futures market, at least in the near term. But again, farther out down the end of the curve, it's not promising. You know, again, if we see the emerging markets bottom, our view is that, you know, we have to look back to 2015 and 16. If we see reversals in their market, one of the best sectors at that time, coming off the, you know, two to three months out from the January lows, was basic materials. And, you know, so I'm looking for reversals in the metals if that occurs. And again, it depends on how strong these reversals are and whether or not investors believe that, you know, China can sustain, you know, whether it's fiscal policy or monetary policy to, you know, push money into investors' pockets. But, you know, time will tell. But that's one of the things that I'm looking at. And I would look for the basic materials to rally if we get the emerging markets to bottom.
So if I was to sum up, Dave, you think right now it's maybe or more likely that we're in a corrective phase looking for a bottom. You're sticking with that. You're not ready to call the top yet. And basically, given where the market is, you would stay with defensives. Would that be correct?
Yeah, I would incrementally be looking at places to shop in terms of whether it's technology. Again, without knowing it's the top at this point in time, again, time will tell. But I'm looking to see, you know, what stocks are near major support levels, horizontal support levels. And that's the type of thing I'm sifting through daily, because we don't know where the exact bottom is going to be. But if this is like 2015, 16, you know, you could take out that preceding low just to scare everyone into a panic. And that's where you'll get the bottom. I don't feel like we've had the capitulatory drop right now. I think everyone's still sitting going, hey, we're going to get the reversal. We're going to get the reversal. We didn't go positive on that last reversal. We said that we were extremely oversold. We could see a bump up. Couldn't have expected a 500 plus point rally, but we've given that all back and then some. Again, it's time. It takes time to make these bottoms. And, you know, it'll be every day we get a new data point, and that's, you know, where stocks trade and what their support levels are. So incrementally, Jim, I would be looking at oversold sectors and looking at support levels on individual stocks and groups to find out where they may bottom. And I'd be looking to, you know, start to nibble at things as they come back in.
All right. Well, listen, Dave, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work you do at Vermilion, tell them how they can do so. I mean, you pretty much covered the markets, just about everything from overseas to domestic to what's going on with things like the dollar, commodity.
Well, we try to do it all. So hopefully we touched upon a subject that your listeners would like to hear. But we can be reached at, again, Vermilion Technical Research. Our phone number is 952-922-7500. Our website is vermilioncap.com. That's one L in Vermilion.
All right, Dave. Well, listen, thanks for joining us on the program. I hope to talk to you again, and have yourself a great holiday season.
Thanks. You too, Jim. Great to hear from you.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
A related development that has not received so much attention, but it is being realized that the advancements in horizontal drilling and fracking can also be applied to conventional oil formations, thereby substantially increasing the productivity in mature and declining oil fields worldwide. And this is already happening in many parts of the world, and it favors countries with high reserve to production ratios. But what this does, this what we call this conventional oil revolution, in addition to the shale oil revolution, it brings a whole bunch of new countries into the picture. It results in a more a distributed and abundant supply, which means that, you know, where we've seen supply disruptions in the important producing regions in the past, it shouldn't have as big of an effect on the oil market in terms of producing these shortages and price spikes in the same way that it did in the past.
Well, the U.S. economy has had a strong start this year with economic growth rates in the 4-3% range, but the Fed continues to raise interest rates. Will that hinder the economy or slow it down, or will they eventually take it high enough to lead us into a recession? Joining me on the program is Ryan Sweet from Moody Analytics. Ryan, let's talk about third quarter GDP number. Came in a little bit less than second quarter, but still very strong in the 3% range. The Fed is expected to meet next month, where they're widely anticipating that they'll raise rates for the fourth time this year. So let's begin with this economy. Are rates beginning to hinder this economy, or is there enough stimulus to keep this thing going?
It's both. First of all, I mean, the economy's got a tremendous amount of momentum. In trend GDP growth, we're running 3%. Earlier on in the expansion, GDP growth was averaging 2%. So we've had this, you know, a noticeable step up in GDP growth. And now some of that's been fueled by the fiscal stimulus, but also, you know, until recently, higher energy prices. And that was boosting energy-related investment. So you throw on top of that strength in energy-related investment, you know, the personal income tax cuts that, you know, provided a jolt to consumer spending. And overall, the economy's just been doing really well recently. The job market continues to tighten. And the Fed, from the Fed's perspective, they see an economy that is growing above trend. Inflation's right around where they want it to be at 2%, and they see an unemployment rate that's trending lower. Therefore, they've been raising interest rates. They're going to raise rates again in December. It's widely expected. But with the rise in short-term rates, long-term rates have begun to follow. And part of the reason is that for the last couple of years, there's been this disconnect between where the Fed saw short-term interest rates headed and where the markets thought there was. And this gap was, you know, fairly enormous. That's begun to close, and that's driving up long-term interest rates. And that's beginning to feed through into other parts of the economy. And you can see mortgage rates are rising. And I think one reason you're starting to see or have seen existing home sales, new home sales, and even some residential construction data begin to weaken is just a reflection of past increases in mortgage rates. So I do think higher interest rates are affecting parts of the economy, primarily those that are interest rate sensitive. So housing is the case study for that. But also, I think rising interest rates are affecting the vehicle sales market as well.
You know, in recent FOMC meetings, the Fed has come out and said, or at least the Fed chairman has, that they're not close to neutral yet. And I don't know what that neutral rate is, but they seem to be implying we've got a lot further to go before we get to that rate. In your perspective, where do you think that is? Is it 3%? Is it 3.5%? What is that number?
Yeah, I think Jerome Powell gave a speech several weeks ago, and in a Q&A, he did allude to that. You know, he said that, you know, monetary policy is far from neutral. I was a little puzzled by that. I think it's more maybe a foot and mouth moment. Now, you know, Fed chairs have, you know, said things in the past, you know, a slip of the tongue, and you know, they kind of walk back on it down the road. Partly because, you know, the Fed's estimate of where the neutral Fed funds rate in the long run is, you know, right around 3%. And that's where we put it at as well. The other thing to keep in mind is that this is not the neutral Fed funds rate is not directly observable. You can estimate it, but there's a lot of uncertainty around that. So we could be at the neutral Fed funds rate now, or it could be a lot higher than 3%. You know, we're really not going to know what the neutral Fed funds rate is until we get there. But I think 3% seems like a reasonable estimate. And that would imply, you know, we just have a few more rate hikes to go before we get there. We think just like in past tightening cycles, the Fed will raise rates more than the neutral rate would suggest. So if we put the neutral rate at 3%, you know, we think this tightening cycle ends at 3.5%. But, you know, the Fed's going to get there very gradually, one rate hike per quarter until they get to 3.5%. Because what the Fed's trying to do, which they have had a very hard time doing in the past, is engineering a soft landing. In other words, they want to try to return the economy to full employment, which the Fed would probably put full employment economy consistent with an unemployment rate at 4.5%. We're at 3.7%. So we have a little bit of distance to go to raise the unemployment rate. And they want to keep inflation running around 2%. I do think the Fed has a chance of engineering a soft landing, but it's going to be difficult. There's going to be some bumps along the road. I think the Fed's going to continue to forge ahead with these rate hikes. And I think talk of a Fed pause seems a little bit premature. The case for a pause is likely more compelling late 2019, because the Fed knows that this fiscal stimulus is going to wear off. The economy is going to be beginning to feel a hangover in 2020 when this fiscal stimulus fades. Financial market conditions are tighter and monetary policy is restrictive for the economy.
Let's talk about something else that they're doing. They're shrinking their balance sheet to the tune of about $50 billion a month. What impact do you think that's having on the Treasury market? Because you effectively have a buyer of $600 billion a year that's absent the market. I mean, that has to have an impact somewhere.
It does. And you can see it in long-term rates. And, by our estimation, the Fed's plan to reduce its balance sheet over the course of the next couple of years, it's like going to add 10 to 15 basis points to the 10-year Treasury yield per annum. And that's primarily going to come through a higher term premium. So, as you know, it's the extra compensation that investors need to hold long-term rates versus short-term rates. So when the Fed's unwinding its balance sheet, it's going to put some upper pressure on long-term rates via the term premium. So the Fed's plan so far, I mean, I don't think it's been overly disruptive to financial market conditions. They've telegraphed what they're going to do. The balance sheet's declining at a glacial pace. But there is a lot more attention being put on the balance sheet, given some of the issues going on in the Fed funds market. The effective Fed funds rate is actually trading towards the top end of the range that the Fed sets. So they have this 25 basis point range that they want the effective Fed funds rate to trade in. Ideally, they want to trade it roughly in the midpoint of that range. But recently, this year, it's been trading on several occasions towards the top end. So the Fed's made some technical adjustments to the interest paid on excess reserves, in an effort to try to push the effective rate back towards the midpoint. I think that's more of a Band-Aid fix, because I think one reason that the effective rate is trading higher than the Fed would like to see it is that the Treasury Department's been on an issuance binge, particularly on bills. And that's driving the effective Fed funds rate up higher as well. So the Fed's going to need a little bit of help to try to push that effective rate towards the midpoint of that target range. But overall, I think the Fed's balance sheet, the reduction, the impact on the economy, financial market conditions really takes second fiddle to the gradual normalization of monetary policy. And the Fed's getting a lot of criticism. Are they raising rates too quickly? Are they undermining the expansion? But a tightening in financial market conditions or a tightening in monetary policy, This is supposed to be painful. It's not supposed to be, therapeutic.
This is, at least in my career, Ryan, the first time I've ever seen the government come out with a massive stimulus program at the end of a business cycle. At the same time, the Fed is raising interest rates. It's almost like the two are working against each other. Given that, can they effectively pull off a soft landing? The only time I've seen them do it was in, I think it was 1994 and 95.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, I think 94, 95 is, in their playbook. They're going to try to replicate that. But, that's kind of, the anomaly. Most of the time, the Fed overdoes it. They tighten or they raise rates too quickly, or they set monetary policy too restrictive. That really causes financial market conditions to tighten. And usually that begins to show some of the imbalances in the economy, they start to bubbles begin to pop, and the economy eventually falls into a recession. This time around, it's going to be difficult, but I think it's achievable, partly because I think the Fed, unlike in the past, recognizes that increases in oil prices have transitory effects on inflation. So, case in point, late 1990s, the labor market was very tight, just as tight as it is today. The one caveat is that it's very difficult to compare the labor market across periods, because the composition of the workforce, the demographics have changed noticeably. But again, I mean, we have a very tight labor market, just like we did in the late 1990s. But it wasn't a tight labor market that caused inflation to accelerate. It was an oil price shock that had a transitory effect, but the Fed, got this knee-jerk reaction. They were worried about inflation rising too quickly, inflation expectations becoming dislodged, and they raised rates, more aggressively than they otherwise would have. And that, eventually led to a recession. It wasn't the only reason the economy suffered a recession, but it was one reason. So I think the Fed this time around, because they're gradually raising interest rates, it gives them the opportunity raise rates in December, look around, see how the economy is doing over the subsequent months, And then decide whether or not an additional rate hike is going to be needed in 2019. But, you know, the Fed's trying to be as data dependent as they can be, but monetary policy, you can't, you know, set it with a rule. You know, there is some discretion that is needed. But I think this Fed is, you know, not going to be reckless. And I think that gives them a fighting chance to pull off, what has been in the past, very difficult to do. And that's engineering a soft landing.
I want to talk about, up until recently, the trifecta. We still have the dollar, which is rising amidst political turmoil overseas. And up until, let's say, the last couple of weeks, we had rising oil and we had rising interest rates. So a rising dollar, rising oil, and rising interest rates. Do you think maybe that's behind some of the slowdown that we've seen recently? Because, I mean, all three of those rising at the same time has to impact the economy.
It does, and you'd be surprised. I mean, our economy is very sensitive to fluctuations in the U.S. dollar. I think the appreciation has been, you know, manageable. I mean, we're still growing above 3%. The increase in oil prices, tracing the effects of higher oil prices on the economy is very difficult because there are some positives and there are some clear negatives. So, on the positive side, when you have higher oil prices, you get, you know, an increase in energy-related investment, and when you look at it through the details of business investment, you know, over the last couple of years, those that are tied to energy-related structures or equipment have been doing very, very well. Outside of that, business investment has been, you know, mediocre at growth in business investment has been mediocre at best. So, higher oil prices do clearly benefit business investment. It hurts you and I, you know, the consumer. Higher oil prices eats away at our discretionary spending on things outside of gasoline stations. But again, I mean, the share of retail sales at gasoline stations has, you know, is much lower than it was 5, 10, 15 years ago or 10 years ago. So I think overall the impact on the consumer is a little bit more modest. But a good rule of thumb is for every dollar or every penny increase in gasoline prices at the pump, it reduces consumer spending by roughly $1 billion over the course of a year. Now, recently, oil prices have dropped, and this is encouraging for the consumer. You know, we should see a little bit of a windfall there for consumer spending over the course of the next couple of quarters, assuming that, you know, the drop in oil prices stick. But this does complicate the Fed's policy path because lower oil prices will be disinflationary a little bit. It's going to reduce headline inflation, but, you know, oil prices do feed into core prices, which exclude food and energy, and they feed into core prices via transportation costs and things like that. So it could be a little bit of a disinflationary effect there. Therefore, the Fed really, you know, from my perspective, they don't really need to worry about inflation. They don't need to, you know, panic that it's going to noticeably overshoot their 2% target. But as you alluded to earlier, fiscal policy is really complicating their mission because you have fiscal stimulus at a time, the economy's at full employment, you know, when we really didn't need this fiscal stimulus. It's essentially put the economy on a sugar high. It's going to create more of a boom bust cycle. We're in the boom phase now. The bust is coming up in 2020, most likely.
I want to talk about two other areas of the economy. Let's talk about the consumer. Okay, so rising oil prices, obviously gasoline at the pump rising, takes dollars out of the consumer. That has turned around or flipped in the last month, but you have consumer confidence at almost record levels. You have rising wages year over year, up 3.1%. So let's talk about the retail season, the Christmas season. It seems like the consumer is firing on all cylinders.
They are. I mean, they have almost everything going for them. And I think this holiday shopping season is going to be the best in recent years, you know, particularly alluding to, I mean, you hit on all the key factors right there. I mean, confidence is strong. Most importantly, I think at this phase of the cycle, given the tightening in the labor market, wage growth is accelerating. And my preferred measure of wages is the ECI for private workers. And that's up right around 3% on a year ago basis. And that's where wage growth should be. So I really don't see, you know, evidence that there's this wage growth mystery because, you know, over time, wage growth is a function of productivity growth, which is running 1%, and inflation. Inflation is 2%. So you add them together, you get 3% nominal wage growth. And that's spot on where we should be. But I do think, you know, given the consumer seeing stronger wage growth, you know, some lower oil prices, high confidence, household balance sheets are in very good shape. And even given the ebbs and flows in equity markets, you know, we still have a small tailwind from the equity market wealth effect. And house prices have been appreciating over the last several years, so you get the housing wealth effect as well. So, you know, the consumer's got plenty of tailwinds heading into this holiday shopping season, so they should be pretty cheery and be spending in droves.
Final question. We know that there was a lot of debt taken out in this economic recovery, especially in emerging markets denominated in U.S. dollars. So now you have rising interest rates in a rising dollar. What impact will overseas have on our economy? In other words, with the problems that we're seeing in areas like Argentina, Turkey, and maybe some of the emerging markets, will that come home to our shores and affect our economy?
The key is going to be contagion, which is a nasty word to financial markets and to economists. In and of themselves, if you know, if troubles are isolated to Argentina, to Turkey, to other emerging economies, the impact on the U.S. economy is pretty minimal, because the way I approach it and, you know, try to assess the risks to the U.S. economy from, you know, some of these problems in emerging markets is to look at the U.S. banking system's exposure to those countries, to look at, you know, our trade flows between these two, between the countries, and then also the potential impact on financial market conditions and confidence. And so far, the problems in emerging markets have very little impact on our economy. I think, you know, the trade tensions, you know, are a much bigger issue because they're generating uncertainty. It's causing businesses domestically to strain to adjust to these tariffs. You can see that in the ISM manufacturing survey. The supplier deliveries index has jumped over the last couple of years, and an increase in supplier deliveries, an indication of slower deliveries. And that's a reflection of, you know, these trade tariffs, trade tensions disrupting the supply chain. So it's not necessarily the dollars and cents of the tariffs that are having the biggest impact on the U.S. economy. It's more these indirect effects, you know, the uncertainty and the disruption to the supply chain. So if anything, you know, globally is going to really affect our economy, it's more these growing trade tensions between the U.S. and China. If they continue to escalate, then the feedback loop onto the U.S. is going to become a little bit more noticeable in 2019. But as you mentioned, talking about, you know, leverage and debt, I'm more concerned about the U.S. leverage loan market. And that's something that we should probably keep a close eye on over the course of the next couple of years.
Finally, you talked about in the past when we saw a spike in oil prices, think 1990, think in the year 2000, the Fed reacted. So perhaps this time they look at that as transitory. Could they do the same with the impact of trade tariffs? Because in some of the corporate earnings reports, a lot of the companies were announcing that their cost structures had gone up as a result of the tariffs. So do you think the Fed may view that as a temporary phenomenon, just like oil, and then ignore it?
They could. I think, you know, the way the Fed is going to probably approach this is, you know, they have to determine whether or not the tariffs are temporary in the sense that, you know, they're just used as a negotiating tool, and that once these trade deals are reached, hopefully sooner rather than later, that the tariffs are reduced. You know, then that way the impact on inflation, you know, is pretty transitory. The other way they could approach it is just see this as a one-off level shift in inflation, and therefore the rate of inflation going forward shouldn't be appreciably changed by these tariffs. But to kind of put everything into context, you know, the tariffs so far, you know, over the course of a year, try to raise consumer prices, year over year growth in consumer prices by a tenth, maybe 0.2 of a percentage point. Not a lot, but given that inflation is running right around the Fed's 2% target, you know, they're not going to stomach a big overshoot in inflation. So, you know, if we get up to measure on the core PCE deflator, 2.2, 2.3, then you're going to see the Fed start to sound a little bit more nervous that inflation is going to be more problematic than they are. Again, I don't think they have to worry about that. I mean, we have, you know, some inflationary impact from the tariffs, but right now we have lower oil prices. That's disinflationary. The appreciating dollar is disinflationary, you know, via lower import, non-fuel import prices. So, and then we also have a demographic headwind for inflation. When you look at periods that we have high inflation in the U.S., you know, you look back at the 1970s, 1980s, the share of the population that was young, you know, 15 to 34, was really high. We don't have that problem now. That's not going to be a problem for the foreseeable future. And I think that's more of a structural headwind that faces inflation going forward. So in the end, I think the risk to the Fed's inflation outlook, and even to our inflation outlook, you know, having it run right around 2%, give or take a little bit, over the next several years is still weighted to the downside, and that the Fed can, you know, be cautious in gradually raising interest rates.
And I guess if you were to take out your crystal ball, final question, looking at the economy, you made reference earlier, given the fact that we have stimulus, but it's going to start to wear off by the time we get to the end of next year, the Fed will be raising interest rates, and they'll probably overdo it. So if you're looking at a bust, 2020 is your best guess, meaning that 2019 could be another good year for the economy.
I always like to end our conversation on a good note, but we'll end on a bad note this time. I think 2019 is going to be a tale of two halves. So the first half of the year, you're going to see a very strong economy. You're going to see GDP growth running right around 3%, which is comfortably above the economy's potential growth rate, which, you know, we probably put closer to 2%. So the economy will still be running, you know, a little bit hot. The unemployment rate will be falling. We're going to get down to 3.2% on the unemployment rate in the first half of next year. So overall, I mean, the economy is going to be very, very strong for the first 6 months of the year. Then the fiscal stimulus begins to fade. Financial market conditions will be tightening. The Fed's going to be continuing to raise interest rates throughout 2019. And I think that's when the economy begins to slow, is towards the end, the second half of 2019 and into 2020. And in 2020, we're going to get hit by this three-headed monster of, you know, fiscal policy will now be restrictive for the economy. Monetary policy will be also applying the brakes for economic activity, and financial market conditions will be tightening. So that's a lot for an economy to digest, and that's going to cause our economy to grow below its potential growth rate. Now, we're not explicitly forecasting a recession in 2020 because economists' track record in forecasting recessions is pretty bad. It's very difficult to get the timing and the catalyst right, usually get one or the other. But I think looking ahead to 2020, all the signs point towards a significant slowing in the economy. We're going to be growing, you know, maybe 1% in 2020. That's when we're vulnerable to any exogenous stock shock. So any sudden tightening in financial market conditions, you know, any strains in China, or if issues in emerging markets reemerge, or there's problems in Europe, that's when we're going to be much more vulnerable to something going on abroad than we are today, because we have a fairly good cushion. I mean, it's going to take a lot to derail this economy, you know, over the course of the next year or so. But in 2020, our economy is going to be much more vulnerable.
All right. Well, listen, Ryan, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you do at Moody's Analytics, I mean, you cover all the major indicators, not only here, but you also cover overseas markets as well. Tell them how they could do so, please.
Economy.com, that is our real-time web service. We cover 300 economic indicators globally, and each day we put out daily commentary on U.S. and international economic and financial market developments.
Well, essential website if you're following the economy. Ryan, thanks so much for joining us on the program.
My pleasure, and thank you for having me.
You bet.
And coming up in hour two, after the volatility with this week's oil prices, you might be thinking, what the hell just happened? How can we go from record prices for the year and calls for $100 oil by year end to a bear market in oil with prices near $50 in just 1 month? What changed? Is this the sign of an approaching recession, a new glut in oil? What's going on? Well, Jim Poplav and I, we unpack all these questions and provide some much-needed insight into the fluctuating oil market. Also, in the second hour, Jim and I will answer the question having to do with record economic growth this year and high corporate profits. And really, all of us are wondering, can the economy keep up the pace? Is this as good as it gets? All of that's coming up in hour two.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.